From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Senate Republicans unveiled their vision to reform policing. The Justice Act is the party's response to weeks of protests and calls to restructure police departments across the country.
The Senate's only black Republican, Tim Scott of South Carolina, was in charge of the effort, and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell praised him earlier today.
Senator Scott has led the construction of a strong proposal that will increase transparency, grow accountability, and advance the cause of police reform without lashing out at the lion's share of brave law enforcement officers who serve bravely and well.
We're joined now by NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. And first of all, Kelsey, what's in this bill?
Well, this bill mostly focuses on incentives and more resources and training to get local departments and agencies to comply with standards on use of force and reporting their data about use of force to a national database. They create incentives to ban chokeholds, and they create a duty to intervene in excessive force. So if an officer sees an officer using excessive force, it would be that officer's duty to step in. There's also money for grants for body-worn cameras and grants to increase police forces. It would also make lynching a federal crime and establish a bipartisan commission to consider future criminal justice legislation.
Now, House Democrats have also offered their own bill on police reform, which goes a lot further to answer some of the demands of the protesters. How does the Republican bill differ from the Democrats' bill?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting to kind of look at these bills side by side and notice that there's a lot of shared language, but there's a really different approach to how they would execute these reforms. You know, there's the talk about incentives like Republicans are using to get local departments to comply with standards, and directives from the House Democrats and actually having some sort of penalties for not meeting those directives. Democrats want an outright federal ban on chokeholds and no-knock warrants, and Republicans, like I said, want to make that incentive, basically making funding contingent upon departments adopting those bans voluntarily. Another example is Democrats want police officers to be held liable for their actions in civil court. Republicans are split on the issue. So we're looking at similar ideas of what needs to be fixed, very, very different approaches on how to get there.
Now, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, the Democrat, praised the House bill, but criticized the Senate's plan this morning. Listen.
We have a tale of two chambers, a glaring contrast between a strong, comprehensive Democratic bill in the House and a much narrower and much less effective Republican bill in the Senate.
So when the Democratic leader says that about the Republican bill, does that mean that Senate Democrats will overwhelmingly oppose the Republican bill?
You know, I found that speech really interesting because Schumer didn't outright reject the possibility of negotiating. He criticized the bill, pointed to the many ways that Republicans didn't go far enough, but he left open the possibility that Democrats could step in and try to amend it. You know, he does say that there's a long way to go and Democrats can't support tinkering around the edges. He talked about replacing an ineffective system with a new system. Now, those are some fairly high demands, and it would be quite difficult to bring the Republican bill to exactly where the House Democratic bill is, but it's possible that Democrats might be willing to do some amending. But I will say that doing a bill like this is really difficult, and it takes a lot of political will and the belief that this legislation, whatever agreement they come to, meets the demands of the base for both parties. And Democrats are hoping to win over voters who are asking for, some of them are asking for things like defunding the police. And that is very, very different than Republicans wanting to give more money to police for training and to increase police presence. So finding that middle ground might be very tricky.
Now, Republicans in Congress often follow the lead of the Republican president, President Trump, who issued an executive order yesterday, which would also ban chokeholds except when an officer's life is at risk. How does what Republicans are proposing today fit into the president's stance on police reform?
Well, I think the best way I've heard it described is they're complementary. So there was consultation, there was an understanding on both sides, the White House and the Senate, about what was being written. We do know that White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows was up on Capitol Hill, and we expect him to continue to be doing that, to kind of be consulting and working their way through. I will say Democrats were very, very dismissive of the proposals or of the executive order that the White House put together. I believe the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called it window dressing.
When could we see this bill brought to a vote? Because time is of the essence here. We're 4.5 months away from an election. It's always more difficult the closer you get to an election to get major legislation through Congress.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we're expecting that this bill could come up next week, which is interesting because the House Democrat bill will probably also come up next week. And so we could be seeing a moment where there is dueling legislation passing out of the two chambers in Congress, which sets up a showdown.
Well, we will be watching all of it, and I'm sure we'll be checking in with you to see what the developments are. Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional correspondent on today's news, the Republican plan for police reform coming out of the Senate. Kelsey, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, some police departments are making changes faster than Congress. Cities around the country have banned police chokeholds and revised use of force standards after the death of George Floyd. But there's still fierce scrutiny. In Columbus, Ohio, residents say the police have failed to exercise restraint or use the minimum amount of lawful force during recent protests. And they say officers are violating the state's crowd control policies, which were written with the help of the city's police chief. WOSU's Paige Flager reports.
Who do you protect? Who do you protect?
On the first night of protests about George Floyd's death and police brutality, 23-year-old Jordan Close was downtown with her friends. Tensions were already running high between police and protesters.
They were telling people to disperse, but they had blocked off like 3 out of 4 of the main streets, so even if people wanted to leave, they really couldn't. And then they just started spraying people, like, indiscriminately.
She says an officer pepper sprayed her from a few inches away. He grabbed her by her hair and the back of her shirt, she says, and threw her into a group of other police officers.
I could not see, but I was kicked in the side, in the rib. Like, as I was trying to get up, they were pushing me down.
For 3 days, police tactics largely did not change, even though there are guidelines on how to handle large protests, written in part by Columbus's police chief, Tom Quinlan.
This document wasn't intended to be a Bible. It was intended to be a guide and make sure officers have the tools available to them to make good judgment decisions on what we should do in ideal circumstances.
The plan is taught to every new officer in the state and lays out guidance on crowd control. It says at peaceful protests, officers should wear their normal uniforms. For non-peaceful protests, it lists protective gear like gas masks, body armor, and shields. It also outlines dispersal techniques. It instructs officers to give 3 warnings before using force. The dispersal warnings should allow a reasonable amount of time for crowds to disperse and should communicate what directions officers want protesters to move in. However, journalists and protesters witnessed multiple instances where a warning was given while officers were already firing projectiles or using chemical agents against protesters. Chief Quinlan defended the police's actions.
It's certainly expected, but there are times where things happen so fast it can't always be given.
The police training document also advises officers that pepper spray should not be used closer than 7 feet, and that exposure can lead to vomiting, chemical burns, or even death for people with health conditions. Katie Berghammer says she and other protesters got no warning at a recent demonstration before they were pepper sprayed from just a few feet away. She was sprayed with her mouth open and vomited. She's the daughter of a retired police officer and says she was shocked by the use of force.
They did not, you know, pull back and say, you know, we're supposed to issue a warning where you're standing too close. You're not supposed to spray that close.
City Council member Shayla Favor was one of several elected officials pepper sprayed by Columbus police officers. The protocol says officers should remain neutral and calm, but Favor says that's not what she saw.
There were moments when I did feel that there was an aggressive approach that was probably unwarranted.
When asked if he felt his officers followed their training, Chief Quinlan said real life is different than the classroom.
Nothing is perfect in application. When we're sitting in a room at a state police academy and writing how this should look in ideally, and then how it looks when balls and rocks and chunks of concrete and fireworks are being deployed, sometimes you have to make adjustments on the fly.
Police did make adjustments. On the fifth night of protests, it seemed some officers were trying to de-escalate, using techniques laid out in their training. They were dressed in their normal uniforms instead of riot gear and engaged with protesters. One man lifted his shirt to show Sergeant Kerry Hollis a bruise on his side from where he was hit with a wooden projectile.
I think we need to find a better way. I think the division needs to take a look at that, and we need to really look at how we do things, and there needs to be change. There always has to be change to be progress, right?
And change may be on its way. Last week, Governor Mike DeWine called for new state minimum standards for how police should respond to protests. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager.
For James McBride, racism in this country has been a disease.
It's been the cancer that has just been killing us. And now we want to address the problem. I mean, you can't address the cancer until you know you have it. And these people are seeing the cancer.
Author James McBride on protests, a pandemic, and his new book. Listen to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Coronavirus is surging in India. The country reported 2,000 deaths in the last 24 hours, and it has the fourth highest case count in the world, more than 354,000. Joining us now is the BBC's Yogita LeMay. She's in Mumbai on Skype. Yogita, we've seen reports that hospitals in Delhi are running out of beds. How would you describe the state of the pandemic in India right now?
Well, India has been lifting its lockdown as coronavirus cases are rising. And this means that we're seeing a spike in the growth or rather the rate of spread of the virus in Delhi, but in other cities like Mumbai as well. In fact, Mumbai is the worst affected city by coronavirus in India. And in major areas of the country, what we're also seeing is that the healthcare infrastructure is struggling to cope. So from Delhi, there have been lots of visuals coming out of people going from hospital to hospital, but unable to find beds, hospital beds for their family members. Here in Mumbai, I've spoke to people who've lost loved ones because they couldn't get an ICU bed and a ventilator in time. One word, though, on the spike in death numbers that we saw yesterday, which was more than 2,000. So part of the reason why we saw such a massive number in one day is that both in the cities of Mumbai as well as Delhi, there were previously unreported deaths. Mm-hmm. So those numbers were sort of added for both Mumbai and Delhi. And that's why we've had a massive sort of jump in the number of deaths.
Still, there is clearly a spike going on in India. What is happening, do you think, that's causing that? Because India had imposed what was described as the world's largest lockdown, major restrictions on the huge population of more than a billion people in India. What sort of restrictions are in place today? Have they been easing up?
Well, yes, they have been easing up to a great extent. For example, in the city of Delhi, workplaces are open. Public transport is, has all been opened up, allowed to run again. Even shopping malls, places of worship, restaurants have been allowed to open. Of course, there are restrictions on the number of people who can dine in a restaurant at a time. But essentially, the streets once again looking like they used to before the lockdown. Here in Mumbai, we haven't had shopping malls or restaurants opening yet, but, the traffic is back on the streets. We are expecting that the suburban train network, this is a very congested local train network that carries around 7 million passengers every day. They are sort of trying to take decisions on when they can reopen that. As far as the rest of the country goes, international air travel so far has not been opened up at all. So that remains mm-hmm. closed. But domestic air travel has restarted.
And are people wearing masks everywhere?
Yes, wearing masks is mandatory in public places. And, you know, just to add that it was a very severe lockdown. But from, you know, what doctors and public health professionals are telling me is that what India needed to have done, given its large population, is to have really aggressively tested and contained the spread of the virus during the lockdown. And that doesn't seem to have happened. So we're one of the few countries in the world that is opening up, that's lifting restrictions, even as the number of cases are rising.
That is the BBC's Yogita LeMay joining us from Mumbai, India. Yogita, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to one of the world's leading epidemiologists for more on the pandemic. Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Doctor, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Well, in 9 states reported either new single-day highs or set a record for 7-day new coronavirus case averages yesterday. What worries you most about the rise in cases we're seeing in many states, especially across the South and the West in the U.S. right now?
Well, I think this is a moment for great humility among epidemiologists and public health officials, because quite honestly, we don't know what's going on. We have 21 areas that are actually seeing case increases. We have 9 that are relatively flat for the last 14 days, and we have 21 that are seeing substantial decreases in cases. And all of them have been going through the same kinds of relaxation of restrictions on movements, reopening the economy. And we're trying to understand exactly what's going on, but we don't.
Well, if we don't understand it, then what should we be doing to make sure that we don't have a substantial second wave?
Well, first of all, let me back up and say this whole wave issue has been very confused. We're still in, I believe, the first wave, which we're seeing this overlap of cases in different geographic areas at different times, but this has not gone away. And so in a sense, this is all still first wave activity. But the question you're asking is a really good one. When we are seeing the kinds of case increases that are happening in places like Florida, in Texas, in North Carolina, we can't ignore that. I don't know how local public health officials and government officials can't try to reduce the number of people who are having close contact in public spaces to reduce that activity. Because right now, some of these intensive care wards in hospitals in those areas are literally at the point of almost overflowing with cases. So the challenge we have is if you're in one area where it's really hot right now, yes, you need to be doing a lot, right, to reduce the potential for new cases. But if you're in an area where cases have been decreasing consistently for the last 2 to 3 weeks, what do you tell the people there? We know that one size fits all isn't going to work in this country.
Well, and some of the information that is coming sounds like what you're saying. And then there is the White House, and there's going to be a Trump rally, a big indoor Trump rally this week in Oklahoma, which is already seeing a spike in cases. The Vice President, Mike Pence, published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying there isn't a coronavirus second wave. The media has tried to scare the American people every step of the way. What's your response to that? Because the message from the White House is very different right now from what you're saying.
Well, first of all, let's just dispense with that first and second wave issue. We're in the first wave. It's serious. It's an important issue in places like Oklahoma. Across the board, we have to understand in areas where we're seeing cases increase, large indoor activities doesn't make any kind of public health sense. I think it's a real challenge in terms of what we might see for cases 2 to 3 weeks later.
What about the issue of wearing masks? There was a study published this week by a team of researchers at Texas A&M University that found face masks dramatically reduce the number of infections. The authors also said other mitigation efforts, including social distancing, are insufficient by themselves, but that masks are very important. Would you say that people can feel pretty safe if they're out wearing a mask in public?
At this point, we have to be really clear about also what we know about masks and what we don't know. I recommend wearing them. I wear one myself, but we have to be really clear. The data on how effective they are is still lacking. And what I'm talking about are cloth face coverings. Many of the studies that have come out recently have been modeling studies that have been frankly deficient, just as the Texas A&M study is. We need data on how effective these face cloth coverings are in both preventing transmission and also from becoming infected yourself. And so at this point, I recommend them. I think we should use them. But we have to tell the public that the number one, two, and three things you can do to protect yourself are distance, distance, and distance. And do not rely on a cloth face covering to protect you or to keep you from transmitting to others.
How much of this country do you think has already been infected with the coronavirus?
The best serologic data we have, meaning studies of antibody presence in the population, would support that between 5 to 7% of the country has been infected. And that's not different than we're seeing around the world. Studies that are coming out of Europe right now, even Asia, even Wuhan, China, we find about 3.5% of people infected there. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, at best, we're at 5 to 7%. There's a long, long ways from getting to 60 or 70% that would be required to develop what we call herd immunity and slow down transmission.
Are you optimistic that there's going to be a vaccine in short order? The vice president seems to think it could come by the fall.
I do not have any sense that there will be a vaccine yet this year that will be both shown to be effective and safe and available to the public. Even having a vaccine sometime next year, I think, would be considered a modern medical miracle. So we have to plan as if we're going to get through this year as if we don't have a vaccine.
I finally want to ask you, it seems like we learn something new about this virus every day. What are you learning about COVID-19 that surprises you or that you think is critical to understanding why it has been so damaging?
Well, I can't say that this is a surprising issue, but what I can say is that the lack of understanding of what's happening right now with case transmission in just one country, the United States, is a challenge. You know, we as public health epidemiologists, people who have spent our whole lives being infectious disease medical detectives, would like to think that we could give the public much more certainty, and we can't. We don't understand why we see 20 states with cases increasing, 20 with them decreasing. What's going on? We don't understand this. I think we all in the public health world have to have real humility right now and just admit we don't understand exactly what's happening and that we'll do our very best to figure it out, to understand it, and to make recommendations about what we need to do to move forward with this pandemic.
That is Dr. Michael Osterholm, who's director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Doctor, thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
Always hard to go to somebody who is supposed to know everything about the coronavirus, and then they tell us that none of us really know that much about it at all. It's Here and Now.
As some states open up, some businesses will already be closed for good. And according to research from the University of California, Santa Cruz, pandemic shutdowns disproportionately hurt Black businesses. The number of Black owners has dropped by more than 40%, much greater than closings for white business owners. Ron Busby is president of U.S. Black Chambers, which calls itself the national voice of Black business. And Ron, you say Black Americans own more businesses directly affected by the shutdown, like restaurants and barbershops, but also that only 30% have ever received a line of credit. And that was problematic when the PPP, the payroll program, came out. What happened?
When they rolled out the payroll protection plan, they told the business owners to go to your existing bank to establish your payroll protection plan or your EIDL loan. The majority of Black-owned businesses don't have that relationship. We may have a checking or a debit card, but actually having a line of credit has been a challenge to Black-owned businesses for decades. And so for many of us, we didn't have the relationship to be able to go to early on to acquire the payroll protection plan or the EIDL loans. When the payroll protection plan came out, we knew that we were going to be up against a challenge. There are 2.7 million Black-owned businesses in the country. But of that 2.7 million, only 114,000 have one employee. So 2.6 million have no employees. So we say they're not mom and pop. They're mom or pop, single employer firms. And so when the government came out with a program and you don't include the businesses that don't have payroll, then you're excluding a large percentage of Black-owned businesses in this country.
You know, and I have watched someone, as they tried to qualify for that PPP, call on their bankers, call on the people who hold their mortgages or that they are renting equipment from. To hear you say that many small business owners who are Black don't have those relationships, yeah, no wonder they would just have to fold.
This is a challenge for the members of our organization. The U.S. Black Chamber has 145 Black chambers in 42 states with a membership base of over 332,000 Black business owners. This is a similar message and concern that we're hearing. So it's not based upon your acumen, it's not based upon your location or business model. It is literally based upon the color of your skin. I could go into a bank, being a Black man, have a white neighbor, have the same business plan. I could own my home, they could rent their home. I could be college educated, they could be high school educated. My white counterpart is going to be called Mr. I'm going to be called Ron. My white counterpart with the same business plan, we both go in asking for $100,000 to execute on that business plan. My white counterpart is going to get his $100,000. I'm going to get $40,000. I'm going to pay 19.98% for that loan. My white counterpart is going to pay 10% for that loan. It's not just the access to capital, but it's the affordability of that capital. The average Black family in America has less than $400 set aside for an emergency or an unexpected bill. And so in a climate like we are facing today, it's very difficult and challenging to look to the future when we have emergencies and unexpected things and challenges happening each and every day for us.
That's Ron Busby, president of U.S. Black Chambers. We'll link you up at hearandnow.org. Ron, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And it's been 3 weeks since George Floyd's killing sent so many people into the streets in outrage, shining a spotlight on systemic racism. But it's also led to rumors and conspiracy theories, dozens of them. They range from the absurd that President Obama mysteriously tweeted an image of a protest sign with George Floyd's face on it 9 days before his death, not true, or that The Simpsons predicted Floyd's death, not true. Then there's the dangerous, the Democrats issued a riot manual for protesters, or the president calling a peace activist in Buffalo, a member of the far left and often violent group Antifa, which, by the way, most research shows didn't have that much to do with these protests. So let's bring back our researchers from Snopes.com. Bond Huberman is an editor at Snopes, which is known as the Internet's premier fact-checking resource. She joins us from Seattle. Bond, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Boy, you guys have been hard at work. You were already working nonstop on coronavirus myths and conspiracy theories. We'll link you to our piece we did about that. And now this terrible death of George Floyd. Talk about the flow of questions and rumors coming in.
Well, as you've already implied, it was certainly a sharp turn that we took from the COVID pandemic crisis and people's, you know, top of mind concern of that to now it's absolutely predominantly about the protests surrounding George Floyd's tragic death. I mean, it almost feels like kind of collective processing of grief. Like at first there's outrage and then we almost like shift into a kind of denial. And now weeks into the story, the audience questions seem to really be focusing on denial. We're even seeing this conspiracy theory emerge. There's some people questioning whether or not Floyd has even died, which is quite, you know, troubling to say the least.
Yes, he did, right in front of our eyes.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Wow. Undeniably and horribly. Kind of in that vein of denial is, you know, these disingenuous arguments or memes that are surfacing online about Floyd's background. Popular is the wrong word for it, but one common rumor that we're seeing going around is that Floyd supposedly put a gun to the belly of a pregnant woman. No documented evidence shows that from our investigation.
All right, there's that. Let's move to Antifa, the very loosely organized, there is no leader, anti-fascist group that grew out of the resistance to the Nazis and has proclaimed it's going to fight fascism. It definitely has, you know, prevented very conservative speakers from speaking in college campuses. But one of the rumors is that Antifa was recruiting on Craigslist for people to go to these protests. Tell us more about that.
Right. So this screenshot of an ad on Craigslist, which right away, red flag, if the most common evidence you're seeing of something happening is a screenshot of an image online, right away, suspect. Mm. Anyway, this ad appeared very briefly, offering to pay up to 1,000 people $25 an hour in Nebraska to, quote, basically cause as much chaos and destruction as possible. The ad was up for a very short amount of time. Our fact checker, Alex Kasprak, looked into it. Completely nonsense. Mm-hmm. And appeared to have been posted after some protest activity in Nebraska in which the advertised chaos and destruction did not manifest. And I should say that fake Craigslist ads are a pretty common tactic. We've fact-checked several of those related to political demonstrators, Trump rallies. Just keep in mind, anyone can create a Craigslist ad. It doesn't take much time at all.
Buyer beware. And by the way, we've reported a lot here on Here and Now about Antifa's ties to these protests and how dangerous these claims are that they are tied. But a lot of this fear-mongering has been encouraged by the president, who not only said that that 75-year-old peace activist in Buffalo was a member of Antifa when he is not, that's already been disproved, but has also said several times that Antifa members are encouraging looting. What did you find?
We did not find evidence of that. I know reporter Alex Kasprak looked into the story, for example, of Martin Gugino, the 75-year-old man who was shoved to the ground by the Buffalo emergency response team. These ridiculous rumors circulated that not only was he supposedly an Antifa agitator, not true, but apparently he was attempting to scan police communications simply by waving his cell phone in front of them.
He was not trying to scan the police.
No, I mean, the idea that you could somehow intercept or jam or scramble police communications by waving your smartphone in front of somebody's body, like, that just doesn't make any sense. But there were reports out there that confused comments from a press conference with the mayor of Buffalo calling someone else an agitator, completely different person, different circumstance, adjacent to the Martin Gugino event. So reports mischaracterized his comments as being about Gugino. That's just a sad example of when a mistake becomes a meme and a rumor and spreads faster than the correction.
Well, another meme has to do with the protesters who are calling for police to be defunded. The meme is that Hitler defunded and eliminated police departments. There's another that claims that he held up a Bible so that when President Trump held up the Bible, he was compared to Hitler. Neither of those are true?
Neither of those are true. On the contrary, Hitler relied on political support of police departments as he was establishing his regime.
How about another meme claiming that protesters vandalized a children's hospital in Texas?
Another great example of when this just tiniest morsel of fact gets served up in this casserole of misinformation and you don't know what's what anymore. A video surfaced that did show protesters throwing objects at a skybridge between two high-rise buildings, and it was not Texas Children's Hospital. It's a completely different neighborhood. But again, that slight tweak between saying a building was being vandalized and saying a children's hospital being vandalized, it gives it that emotional edge that is more likely to capture people's attention and get them to share it.
Well, and let's take another one. The picture that's circulating showing the Lincoln Memorial defaced with graffiti reading Black and Brown Lives Matter. Trayvon Martin's name is scrawled across the statue. It was published on June 8th, went wild on social media.
I would think we'd be hearing more about it if that happened. It doesn't seem to have happened.
Exactly. Didn't happen. Now, there has been graffiti on national monuments, and certainly pertaining to this issue, but not the Lincoln Memorial. Not the image that we fact-checked showed the Lincoln Memorial absolutely covered tip to toe. We did not find evidence that that is true.
It's just often so disheartening. I mean, to think that anyone would think that this has all been a hoax. You know, we follow Snopes.com. We know how many rumors there are. But to think that, you know, there are people, and we probably shouldn't be surprised, there are people trained to think that anything they see on broadcast media is a hoax. But to think that there are that many people who think it is a hoax that George Floyd died. And can I just ask you just about that? Do you get people who thank you for setting them straight, or do they argue with you? I mean,
all of the above. We get a range of emotions in the responses to our content, but absolutely a lot of readers do send genuine thanks for the information that we provide. And some even come clean that they've been corrected by friends or family who sent them to us. And they've been really grateful to find the sort of measured, informative response that, you know, we're not here to guilt or shame. We just want to understand.
Bond Huberman from the fact-checking website Snopes.com. We'll link it herenow.org. Bond, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
And by the way, Snopes is also still dispelling myths about COVID-19. So here we go, among the most recent, that the Captain America movie predicted the coronavirus pandemic. It did not. That 59 people died after a pastor asked them to drink Dettol antiseptic soap. Not true, although please don't drink bleach. That Melinda Gates wore an upside-down cross during interviews about the pandemic to denounce Christianity. She did not. And finally, that Chuck Norris died of COVID-19. He did not. In fact, the 80-year-old is doing just fine.
According to the Cook Political Report, there are 17 Senate races that could be competitive this fall. Democrats need to flip just 3 or 4 seats to take control. To start off our 2020 Senate Tracker series, let's look at the race in North Carolina, where Republican Senator Tom Tillis is facing a challenge from former Democratic State Senator Cal Cunningham. Jeff Tiberi is Capitol Bureau Chief at North Carolina Public Radio. He's in Raleigh. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Jeremy.
All right, so let's go through the candidates here. Some people may know about Tom Tillis. He was elected to this seat in 2014. He's been talking about his background as he's campaigned. Here's an ad he released last week staged in a restaurant kitchen.
Monday afternoon. That's payday in the restaurant business. I know, because that used to be me. Short order cook. Instead of college, I went to work. Got my degree at night. Worked my way up to partner at IBM. Today, 1 million North Carolinians are out of work. Most of them living paycheck to paycheck and forgotten by our politics.
Okay, so he's focusing on the economics there. What has Senator Tillis's record been like in Washington?
Overall, he has been a very consistent Republican vote, and perhaps more so in the last 2, 3, 4 years. He has very much aligned himself with the president. He's voting, per the analysis done by the website 538, he has voted with President Trump's desired position more than 93% of the time.
More than 93% of the time. Has that helped him or hurt him in North Carolina?
Jeremy, you know, it's interesting. Tillis was something of a political outsider. He hasn't really been in this game for 20 or 30 years. He ran for the state house. He quickly ascended to the Speaker of the House here in North Carolina. And when he elevated to the U.S. Senate 6 years ago, he definitely had a pragmatic streak and was seen as somebody who would work across the aisle and somebody who had a real motivation and energy to get things done. And that has certainly shifted. And one example of when that shifted was the time, briefly, a couple of years ago, when he actually opposed President Trump's effort to build a border wall. Now, he did an about-face on that, and he really has tried to present himself as an ally of the president. And part of that, of course, was because we were heading into a primary. But now, of course, we're past the primary. We're heading toward the general election. And I think that in some ways we're going to see a little bit of a pivot toward the middle, but not too much, because it's likely that as the president goes here in November, we'll go Tillis.
Well, it's interesting. We're probably going to see that in a lot of Senate races where after the primary is over and they know they don't have to worry about the base, they can sort of move away from the president a bit if they're a Republican candidate. Tillis's opponent is North Carolina Democratic State Senator Cal Cunningham, an Army veteran who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Here's his video where he announced his candidacy last year.
I've been listening to folks all over North Carolina. Too many who are a busted water heater away or a rent check away from falling into debt. They're having a hard time paying for insulin, their asthma inhalers, the cost of prescription drugs in general. And then entire swaths of North Carolina have been set back, communities hit by flooding and the storms that have hit our state. Somebody's got to do something about it.
What more can you tell us about Cal Cunningham and what he's running on?
Yeah, so Cal Cunningham was a state senator almost 20 years ago now. He is a veteran, served in Iraq, and actually ran for U.S. Senate 10 years ago. He lost in a runoff Democratic primary, and he was not the first pick of the Democrats here in this go-around to try to unseat Tillis, who's vying for a second term. But Cunningham is the pick. He has spent some time talking about environmental issues. He also has said he wants to put a constitutional amendment and do away with Citizens United. So those are a couple of things that we've heard about from him.
What are the polls saying about this race? This is obviously a purple state. The seat was formerly held by a Democrat before Tillis had it. What are the polls saying?
And before that, the seat was held by a Republican. The polls indicate that this is a close race. As we think about this race 6 years ago, when Tillis beat the incumbent, the late Kay Hagan, that race was decided by about 46,000 votes, which was a 1.5 percentage points. And that was out of 3.5 million votes cast. North Carolina is a rapidly growing state. We might see 5 million votes, 4.5 or 5 million votes cast in 2020. And again, the margin is expected to be pretty tight. And I've talked to some analysts and strategists who think that North Carolina may be the tipping point. They look at it as if North Carolina goes blue, it's probable or possible that Colorado and Maine and Arizona, these other toss-up states, may also go blue. So if Cunningham is to defeat Tillis come November, it might be the 50th or 51st seat that Democrats were to hold in the next Congress.
And I imagine as a result of that, a lot of outside money is coming into this race.
Yes, in a word, this has a chance to maybe hit $150 or $170 million in spending, both direct spending from campaigns, outside attack ads from dark money groups, and will be one of the very most, if not the most expensive U.S. Senate race in history.
That is Jeff Tiberi, Capital Bureau Chief at WUNC in Raleigh. Jeff, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.